dispose of with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the show, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. This week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to shed some light on photonics. It's a remarkable field of science that is poised to bring us some amazing new technologies that in the past were only dreamt of in the realm of science fiction. Just as applications of electronics have expanded dramatically since the first transistor was invented in 1948, the unique applications of photonics continue to emerge. Those which are established as economically important applications for semiconductor photonic devices include optical data recording, fiber optic telecommunications, laser printing, displays, and optical pumping of high-powered lasers. The potential applications of photonics are virtually unlimited and include chemical synthesis, medical diagnostics, on-chip data communication, laser defense, and fusion energy, to name several interesting additional examples. With that in mind, it's now my pleasure to welcome, if you will pardon the expression, one of the leading lights in the field of photonics to Radio In Vivo. Dr. Tuan Vo Dinh is director of the Fitzpatrick Institute for Photonics at Duke University, where he is also R. Eugene and Susie E. Goodson Professor of Biomedical Engineering. He joined the faculty at Duke just last year after nearly 20 years at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. Tuan earned his B.S. and Ph.D. degrees at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. In his distinguished career, he has written or edited several books in the field, has published more than 330 scholarly articles, and he is editor-in-chief of the journal Nanobiotechnology. He has won numerous awards for scientific excellence and achievement, and he has been awarded more than 30 patents for his inventions. Tuan Vo Dinh, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here.
Tuan, it's great to have you here in the Triangle, where I'm sure there's a very active scientific sub-community devoted to photonics. After your nearly 20 years at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, what attracted you to join the faculty at the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke?
In fact, I'm really delighted to be here. I think that What I think when I come here is that Duke University have really a tremendous potential by bringing all the discipline together. In fact, that's what you want to achieve at the Fitzpatrick Institute of Photonics. This is kind of an institute which has a platform on photonics. And you know, photonics is kind of a science of light and matter interactions. And within this platform, our goal is to bring all the scientists, engineers, clinical researchers together, and from three schools, not only from the engineering school, but also from the Trinity School, Life and Science, and also from the medical school. And I think that at Duke University, I see that collaboration, that convergence of all these disciplines together, and that's why I'm so excited to be that. Together, I think we can achieve things that neither one of us, individual, can achieve in our lifetime. So I think that hopefully together we can make an impact in the developing technology, instrumentation, methods that could be improve human health.
I see, and I know that's certainly one of your primary interests, and it would certainly seem that the types of biomedical photonic devices you work on would absolutely require that type of multidisciplinary approach.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, you know, one of my goals when I come to Duke and to the Institute is to try to bring all of these, expertise together. I'm very proud and very excited to see that positive response from all the faculty. About a year and a half ago when I joined Duke, our institute has about 25 professors, faculty, and just after a year and 18 months later, we have now 60 faculty, 60 research groups from all the three schools, and the really footprint is very large. We have over 21 departments that involve in our institute. And I think that, again, I keep coming back to the theme, one of the major strengths of a university like Duke is provide that cross-disciplinary interaction between all the faculties.
I see. Well, Tuan, I know that photonics-related technologies are at the heart of telecommunications. We're certainly all familiar with how important fiber optics has been, for example. But I understand that photonics are beginning to revolutionize other fields as well. And why don't we start with one of the fields in which you've certainly been pioneering photonics applications, biophotonics. What exactly is that?
Yeah. Let me start first talk about the institute and the faculty and come to what I'm doing personally.
Sure.
Because I think it's important to see how the spread of talent and also expertise and resource at the institute. At institute, photonics really encompass, like you mentioned, so many things. And I go, we have separate, in broadly in 8 programs at the institute, and each program is directed by a program director. And let me show just a quick look what are the programs which the photonics encompasses.
Sure.
For example, we have the biophonics, you just mentioned, and Dr. Professor Izat, Joe Izat, is a program director. And then we have also a program on nanomicrosystem, which, how to use, the microchip technology as we know it, to devise a small device that could, be used at the point of care. And then we have a program on, we call photonics material. And there, Professor David Smith is the program director. And as you know there, we can devise new material, like the very famous cloaking material that Dr. Smith just devised,
right,
to do all these magical things. We have a program we call information technology. And we use their quantum optics, which is a transmission of light. We think that's the next generation of fiber to communication is used on single photon transmitting, and Professor Dan Gauthier is a program director. And then we have program we call nanophotonics that use the nanobiotechnology combined with a very small scale dimension of device, and Professor Cam Leong is program director.
Mm-hmm.
And we have also a program called integrated systems, and there we try to bring all the different into a systems level. And many professor and Monty Reichert, Dr. Monty Reichert, is a program director. And also, finally, we have a program we call novel spectroscopy. In this, we just devise a really, cutting-edge, high-risk technique, and Professor Warren is a program director. So this is kind of the range, as you say, wide variety of range of phonics can do. And coming to your questions, so
okay,
what is biophotonics? What I'm doing personally in that field of biophotonics? Of course, as the term entail, it involves photonics and bio. So mm-hmm. the idea is to bring the how to combine the molecular biology, the biomedicine, and phonics together, using phonics as a platform. And personally, I'm involved in a couple of technology. One of them that I started when I was at Oak Ridge is to use, for example, light to detect cancer. And how you do that? Yeah, most of the time, you know, people, when they screen for cancer, let's say my project involved is GI, gastrointestinal cancer.
I see.
So then I call back with Dr. Jean Overhaul at the Thompson Cancer in Knoxville. And usually, you know, you have to come to the doctor and then, you know, they put an endoscope and then take, a piece of tissue, a biopsy,
sure.
send out mm-hmm. to the laboratory. And then you wait for days or weeks to get the results. And it's kind of invasive. It kind of very stressful. So what we do here is that we put a light, again, it comes a light, into an optical fiber, that tiny fiber that you insert into the endoscope. And while the doctor is looking at the tissue, he or she just touched lightly the wall of the GI tract. And in about half second, we send 10 light pulses. And the light pulse touch the tissue, bounce back. There's an emission called luminescence that bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer detect, and we can say cancer or not. So we have been very lucky, very successful in the GI. We have tried over 1,000 measurements, test over 200 patients. And we were 90% success rate in terms of comparing with the biopsy. So this is one example of the biophotonics that we've been working.
I see.
Yeah.
That is certainly remarkable. And, you know, if that is perfected, certainly would be a significant step forward.
Oh, definitely. I think that, scientists like us at Duke and all over the world is a kind of looking forward to the day that really this kind of technique being, work on, apply in the street. And I think, again, I come to the back to the point that at Duke University, with the close relationship between the engineering school, the art and science, and the medical school, we have that great potential to bring that together. I've been working very much with, the Duke Comprehensive Cancer Center mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. with Dr. Kim Lively, who is the director. And with that, I work with several medical clinical scientists there, like Dr. Vicky Sewall, Neil Spector, Gathery Devi, and also Dr. Mark DeHertz. So, again, I see that the tremendous amount of resources in the clinical to speed up the time period from the research in the bench to the bedside.
Absolutely. Well, I know that that's been a hallmark of your career, is that translation into actual usage.
Definitely. In fact, sometimes I do several things, and one of the things that I really believe in, and I really have fun in doing that, is that I call it science for a purpose, because I think that, it gives some kind of meaning how science can be translated and can provide some kind of societal value to whatever we can bring to the society.
Absolutely. Well, Duan, let's walk back a little bit, because I know that biophotonics is not a brand new science. Tell us about what types of biophotonics applications are already perfected and in use. And I know that you are, in fact, and your past colleagues are responsible for some of those.
Yeah, I think that light has been used for a long time. In fact, since the time of the Greeks, the Romans, and also the Indians, the healing power of light. In fact, even the worship of the sun come from the fact that light had brought to humankind incredible value, not only for how it shined into our light, but it just the therapeutic kind, or even I would say spiritual kind of value. But I think one of the main things that really pushed this technology into the limelight and the application is to discover a couple of key technology And those technology, I think that appears in, I would say, the 50s, when, you know, the first discovery of the laser, like Charles Townes, Dr. Charles Townes, who got the Nobel Prize in discovering the laser. And we were very fortunate to have him in, I think, give the keynote at the last year meeting at the Fitzpatrick Institute.
I see.
And, you know, with that discovery of the laser, now, you know, we can have a tiny laser, very low cost, that can be used into devices to detect, for example, different type of disease. The other technology that come into light and provide that impetus to, you know, push physics technology is the microelectronic technology in the 50s and 60s again. Mm-hmm. You know, the microchip that now run our PC is the same technology that provide these very sensitive detectors that is, in fact, the eye, the sensing eye of whatever we can want to detect at the disease. So those two combinations are just, I would say, just an example. And again, you know, any technology come from a convergence of so many technology. The other one is information technology. Mm-hmm. You know, all the things that you can now treat the data, you know, use a microprocessor, also provide this brain power into the photonic device to get the data and process data. So I just give you, these are the technology that have a converge and provide, you know, the growth of the photonics technology.
So, and all three of those basic technologies you mentioned have, you know, progressively become more powerful, much smaller.
Definitely, more power, much smaller, and also much cheaper. Because I think this is a paradigm shift in healthcare, I would say, for the last 10 years. Before, what we want to do is that to improve healthcare at any cost. That was, I would say, 10 years ago, even on the research, if we have the biggest CT scan, the biggest MRI, the biggest whatever, PET scan, that's the thing. But then again, you know, we realize that, you know, with the healthcare cost increasing at a very, I would say, a high rate, we cannot, when we see as a society.
Of course.
You know, we cannot really, you know, take care or affect as many people as we would like to. So suddenly the healthcare come to a crossing point. How can device technology to help the most people at the least cost so we can reach out and touch so many people? And that's where I would say all the technology that decrease in size, in cost, come into really, you know, play.
I see. And that's certainly one of the advantages as biophotonics moves forward.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of the, I think the direction. There's many direction. One is at the research level. Mm-hmm. In the laboratory, you use the most exciting, the most I would say expensive sophisticated technology to look at the fundamental science, and that I think should be encouraged and should be continued, because what we do at the fundamental level and basic science could impact years from now what we can discover. So definitely that should be going on. But the other thing I think which should be in parallel is that to develop practical, cost-effective technology to push, you know, all the development, the translation from really the laboratory into the street in a very cost-effective manner.
Yeah, absolutely. Twana, I would like to read you a quote attributed to you and kind of just get you to elaborate on it. I read that you said that, quote, "optical technology will lead to tools that can provide real-time, non-invasive diagnostics," which you've already started alluding to. "This could change the course of medicine in diagnosing early stages of disease, because no tissue has to be removed and the diagnosis is made instantly." You've already talked about that in terms of diagnosing cancer. What other types of diseases is that technology potentially going to be applied to, and how close are we to seeing tools like this in common use?
Yeah, I think that is the potential of photonics. In the sense of photonics is a kind of packet of light, which is a very non-invasive in the sense that you can send light to anything that can be accessible to. Mm-hmm. And we just see now just the tip of the iceberg. you know, when we see, you know, non-invasive using optical fibers in our, I would say, wildest dream, I would say, but I think it could be realizable in 5 or 10 years, is that, you know, to have light that can go through tissue, you know. For example, you know, to replace, I wouldn't say not replace, because I think that each technology, that each modality have its own value, but to have a complementary additional to improve detection, light that can go through tissue within centimeters. Like, for example, give you an example, you can send a pulse of light to the breast, and then instead of have a CT scan, you can see, for example, the lights bounce back through the tissue and detect without with the algorithm to, you know, to convert that into a signal that is medically significant. Mm-hmm. That is an example that I can non-invasive. The other one is, I would say, something that you can detect early marker disease, because this is, again, one of those paradigm-shifting concept. Not detecting disease when it appears, which is why you see the decrease of, let's say, for cancer that you heard the last couple weeks on the newspaper. Mm-hmm, why? Mm-hmm. Because we can now have the capability to detect at the early stage. And that's where I think that light technology, for example, a microchip, like, let's see, you know, years from now, I would say 5 years could be, for example, you can go to a doctor's office and you can take just, you know, a tiny drop of blood or even the saliva, and you can detect there at the doctor's office using light-based technology early markers of disease. And that could be diabetes, that could be, you know, again, you know, all sorts of disease. It doesn't have to be just cancer. It could be heart disease. You know, people, a lot of incredible research now is being, you know, devoted to look at all the markers that occurs at the cells level before really, you know, it come to the tissue level. So this is something that I think very exciting.
And the light technologies would be useful to be able to detect those types of biomarkers.
Yeah, the light, I would say, is one, the key technology that could provide that that modality. And talking about non-invasive, one of the things I would say also very important is the so-called global health. And at Duke, there's that emphasis in global health. Mm-hmm. And with the lowering the cost of the instrumentation, with the advent of the microchip device, hopefully one day we can devise very inexpensive, very small, you know, microchip-based technology that can really, you know, provide those tools to detect, you know, in a remote location where, you know, you don't have all these laboratory expensive, sophisticated analysis in, I would say, call a resource-limiting area, mm-hmm, in all the corner of the world.
So these potentially would be portable, very durable and affordable technologies in the poorer areas of the world.
Yeah, I think this is one of the goal that we at the Institute would like to see.
I see. Well, that's certainly very laudable that that's so prominent in your thinking.
Oh yeah, I'm very excited about that kind of thought and the potential of we can contribute something to that direction.
I see. Tuan, how will the types of tools you've been describing, how will they contribute to a systems biology approach in terms of the research to characterizing the complex networks and pathways that comprise our functioning bodies and the cascades of effects when things go wrong, so that we start to understand some of the basic mechanisms at play? How will photonics tools contribute to that?
Yeah, this is an area of really exciting research. The key of system biology comes from the fact that maybe I would say 10 years ago, people look at studying system. I believe this is one of those, again, a big shift in science. Let's say 50 years ago, we look in science at just, you know, looking at one particle at a time, one atom at a time, one molecule at a time. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, we get all the data, all the information. And then with the sophistication, advance of science, we go to multiple molecules, multiple atoms at a time, you know, when the computer, they're, you know, getting bigger. And now, you know, with the, I would say, the advance of molecular biology, And we have now the knowledge enough, we can start thinking about as a system, just an example, a system, in order to know how does it progress. We look at, let's say, consider, let's say, the fundamental basis of one cell. The cell is, you know, the I would say, the basic unit of life. Mm-hmm. Well, if we don't, the traditional techniques is, let's say, to know what's going on when the cells get injured or get diseased. What we do is that we break the cells, we send it into an analysis. It could be a mass spectrometry, a liquid chromatography, something that really break the pieces of the cells and look at it. And then it has been doing fine. I'm always admiring all of these people who can get all the data in textbook that we learn. But now with the photonics technology, what we can do is go inside a single human cell, a living cells, and look why the cells are alive. What's going on? So, for example, in my lab, what we do is we call a nanosensor technology. Mm-hmm, so we pull a fiber at about 50 nanometers size at the tip. And 50 nanometers is very small because 1 nanometer is kind of the size of 1 molecule of benzene, you know?
Right.
1 molecule. So we pull down fibers. And at the tip, the fiber, we put we call a receptor, something that can detect a very specific molecules, a marker in the cells. So we have a cell, and then we have this tiny that we can poke into the cell. Because it's so tiny, it does not injure the cell as much as it is a big one. In fact, we have shown that the cells, you know, can survive nicely. There's a lot of research in that area because there's, in vitro fertilization research over the last 50 years had demonstrated that, you know, you can do those things and the biotechnology, have shown that this technology is compatible to the cells. So we can stick into the cells and then we can see what's going on, why the cells is still living with all the metabolic effect, all the cellular pathway is still going on, and detect at the systems level. And that's why the systems biology, you know, can be now investigate.
Mm-hmm. So this is not
example.
Only to characterize what's going on in the healthy/normal cell, but also pathologies that may be at work.
Yeah, that's the key thing. Because when we see what are the, you know, the pathway, the markers in the healthy cell, definitely then you can see what changed when the cells are diseased. And one thing which is, I think, which is very interesting, because I've been working with several doctors at the medical school, Dr. Neil Spector and Gareth Devi, for example, to look at what happened when the cells is challenged by a drug, like a cancer drug. So mm-hmm, to see how effective is the drug. So we can, you know, incubate the cell with the drug. In the case where we look, for example, let's take an example as a breast cancer drug or something. And then, you know, we can see the pathway before and after. And looking after, you know, the drug's incubation, then when can we detect how effective is the drug?
I see. Would that involve whether the cell survives the treatment?
The cell survive, but you mentioned in your first question that what is a caspase pathway, for example. Mm-hmm. One thing very interesting when we look at this, there's a process called apoptosis. And right. Apoptosis is that, you know, when the cell dies, it's kind of a trigger, a mechanism that killed itself.
Right.
And it's very important because
vital to life.
Vital to life. So what we look at, we can go into the cells, and we were able to demonstrate just a couple of years ago, the first time, to look at pathway of apoptosis of the cell life after we treat with the cancer drug.
I see. And one of the hallmarks of cancer is the stopping of apoptosis, right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So you get this uncontrolled growth.
Yeah.
I see. Well, that's absolutely fascinating, Tuan, and sounds like it will be very significant to learn some of those basic mechanisms at work. I'd like to ask you about another important area of application for these devices, and that is the analysis of gene expression. How does biophotonics play into the high-throughput gene expression assays that are so prevalent today?
Yeah, we have a couple of technology on that. You know, let me talk about two technologies, one of a biochip and one of high-throughput assay. So, you know, when you get disease, there's many factors why you get disease. People always say, you know, there's a defect in the gene, so it's come from your gene. But also it comes from, the second one is from the environment. So, you know, the environment affect what you have been exposed to and could affect your health. And also the lifestyle. Of course, you know, people don't try not to think about that, but it is your decision, you know, responsibility in life. So there's those three factors. So gene is one of them. So what happened is that when you have, let's say, a defect gene, it's come from many things. The gene could be affected by so many things, a mutation, you know. The gene is kind of series of coding, you know, your nucleotides or molecules and things like that. And when, you know, there's a switch, for example, or a defect, then suddenly, you know, the allogenic code is kind of go wrong. And then it creates some wrong protein or some wrong pathway.
And there are some diseases that are directly attributable to genetic defects.
So what we can do is that we can design a photonics probe that is in our lab. We have a probe that can bind to the gene. And the binding to the gene is called hybridization. It's a term that, you know. So, for example, you know the code of, let's say, of a gene for prostate cancer. Okay, then you design a probe that is can bind to that correct sequence, and then if you bind and there's the sequence is defect, then you don't see it, the binding, you don't see hybridization. So in a simpler word, if you can find the gene that have a label, and those label can be a photonic label, that means that you can detect with the optical detectors, then you can have an assay, a detectors or a chip that can see that, you know, defect gene. That is, in simple, that's what we can do. The other thing is that we can also look into a high-throughput screening. That means another way to look at the gene is that there's an assay that we call it, you can send a piece of DNA into the cells, or, you know, or you can break the cells. And when those pieces of DNA hybridize, they change the conformation. They open or close. And when they open or close, again, I don't want to go into detail, it changed the color of the label. So this is a kind of a few, I would say, advances and almost tricks, tiny tricks that we find in the lab to detect gene expression and gene mutations.
And you have the algorithms all in place to basically read those pulses that you're getting, read those signals that are coming.
Yeah, we have all the detectors and all algorithms to read all these changes at the genes level.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Tuan Vo Dinh, and Tuan is director of the Fitzpatrick Institute for Photonics at Duke University. Tuan, we've talked about the applications of photonics for detection and diagnosis. Where are things in terms of potentially using some of these technologies for therapeutic applications? Is it possible to use devices like this for actually very highly targeted delivery of drugs, for example?
Yeah, of course. There's a lot of interest in using light for therapy, and I just mentioned two examples. One of them, which is starting to get recognized, is a so-called photodynamic therapy. And what it is is that therapy using photons, which is using light. And for example, you have drugs, you know, and then you can inject the drugs to a person, that patient, and that drugs, you know, get into the body systemically. But, you know, in the case, let's say, for cancer, which I'm familiar with, working with Dr. Geneva Hall, who is specialized in photogrammetry of cancer, well, I learned that, you know, the drug get into the tumor more selectively. And one of the reasons, because, you know, tumor grow faster, so absorb the drugs much, much stronger. So when the drug get into the cancer cells, what we do is that we shine the lights on the tumor, and the drugs, the photonic therapy drug, which stands for PDT drugs, absorb the light, And when they absorb the light, in the drug trigger, I don't want to go too much detail, but it trigger singlet oxygen, which is a very kind of toxic substance in the cell and kill the cell. So in this case, you have more tumor cells that absorb more drugs. And when you shine the light, the drug kills the cell. So this is a photochemotherapy drug. Right.
And that's something I'm familiar with. That's been in development for many years. Is that to the point where it's starting to reach the clinic?
Yeah, in fact, you know, just recently, within the last 3-5 years, that it has been accepted by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, of the phytophthalein. That's why usually take some time, easily several decades from the research to the clinic. So this is just recently just been accepted. So this is one of the technologies that photonics can provide to therapy.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, that's very exciting, and it's also very exciting that it's actually reaching the clinic and out there doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I think it was some very encouraging news that we can get. Yeah,
Tuan, I wanted to ask you also. These types of devices are also, and I know this is an area you've been very active in the past, are valuable as sensors for environmental applications. Can you tell us about the kinds of devices in that field?
Yeah, of course, there's a lot of parallel in sensor for the improvement of human health or sensor for potential for the environment, those technologies are very transferable. So, and also I think provide that kind of a nice societal value in both way. And I've been active in sensor for environmental because I think that's where our first line of defense, in the sense that, before you get exposed, before a toxic compounds get into the body, either through skin contact, the ingestions, or just, by breathing the air.
Sure.
We need to see how can we detect the toxic compounds or the potentially hazardous compounds. So sensor photic has tremendous potential and has been contributing already to the sensing. So for example, you can do optical fibers that can dip into hazardous waste stream, and then you send light through the fibers, it reach the tip of the fiber, and then you can detect using spectroscopy. That means you can detect the signal. So, mm-hmm. So how can you detect use spectroscopy? Every compound has a signature, a light signature. We call it spectral signatures. So when you shine the light into a compound, the compound absorbs energy, and then go to, I call it an excited state, a higher level energy state, and it come back. When it come back, it releases light. So that's why you detect that release light that we call a fluorescence. Each compound has its own fluorescence. So this is one typical spectroscopy. The other one is another one I can talk is a Raman spectroscopy. What happens is that when you shine a laser light into molecules, a toxic compound, for example, then the molecule vibrates, and when the light scatters back, it kind of modulates the energy of that vibration. So you see that vibration by analyzing the light back, and that's called a Raman spectroscopy. This, by detecting all this, you can detect really remotely, you can detect all the toxic compounds, in the waste stream, in the air, on the surfaces.
And I know that's a big area of progress in the environmental field, is the ability to have these low-cost, high-sensitivity detectors and sensors all over the world eventually.
Yeah, of course, this is one of the things that I think hopefully contribute to us to have a sustainable world, because in a sustainable world, we need to look into the environment, mm-hmm. how we can be compatible, what our daily activity does not affect the environment as much. And the center, I think, is one of the major parts that would help to do that.
Terrific. Well, that's going to be exciting to watch that unfold over the coming years. I know that, Tuan, that one of the major initiatives in the field of environmental health and efforts to characterize gene-environment interactions, which you discussed a moment ago, is also the development of personal exposure sensors that can very precisely detect everything an individual is exposed to. Are you working on that type of device?
Yeah, in fact, I have been working for a long time that device.
Okay.
A little bit less now because we ship to the biomedical, but this is still very important. Again, it's one of very important change in term of environmental exposure modeling. Before, the standard technique is to use what we call a stationary detector that detect the exposed area. But then one realized, and again, that is in the 80s, but then, people are still working because this is so important, is it to look at the microenvironment exposure. Let's just take an example. Suppose you detect at a street corner, the amount of carbon monoxide or amount of ozone, things like that. But you don't know who walked through that street, during the day.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a dosimeter that can, follow that person, something very cheap, inexpensive kind of a detector, then you can follow over time that exposure. And that can provide a much better, degree of exposure rather than those stationary sensors.
I see. I know I've read some studies where devices like that are used to, for example, follow school children through the course of an entire day, to see where they are getting exposed to various things and in what amounts.
Absolutely. That is something that study like that provide incredible amount of information, which is very accurate and very relevant in terms of human exposure, rather than, those larger, sensor stationary that you can see. So I see a lot of advances, a lot of development in that area of a microsensor for personal exposure monitoring.
Well, it should be, again, very, very exciting to watch where that goes and the types of data and studies that come out. You talked a little bit about nanoscale technologies, and I'd like to pick your brain a little bit more about that. How does the development of nanotechnology, how is it influencing the development of photonic technologies? I'm sure the two are going hand in hand, such as you described with the ability to look inside a living cell. Are you working directly with people who are developing nanotechnologies as well?
Yeah, definitely. Nano is a very important area of focus at our institute. I want to mention, sometimes you ask me what is the focus of our Fitzpatrick Institute and what is a brand name, and I think it's a nano bio info opto. So the conversion of the nanotechnology, mm-hmm. the molecular biology, the information technique under the platform, the optical kind of platform. So nano definitely is one of our focus. And why nano? In fact, nanotechnology is something that has become, I would say, sometime into hype for the last 5 years, but it's very important. Rightfully, it's a technology that could, change how we look at science, at technology. For example, when you look at the macro level, at the bulk level, a substance, something like that, but when you go smaller and smaller, at the nano level, which is at the atomic level, or molecular level, suddenly you discover new properties that you could otherwise have found. So, for example, in the photonics, for example, when we pull fiber down to nanometer, suddenly we are in the regime that we call near field. We discover light doesn't go through that as in classical optics, and we can detect, in cells, things using that kind of effect. For example, another thing that we have been working is a so-called plasmonics. It's one of those terms, that we sometimes scientists create to confuse people. No, I'm joking there. But plasmonic is a kind of, the oscillations of electrons in metals. And those, when the size of those metal particles becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, at the nano kind of scale level, those amplification coming from this oscillation become tremendous, they're giant really. And those giant field created by those plasmonics fields, create a really a strong enhancement in the signal. So this is something, for example, we divide in our group your nanoparticles metals that can we attach to a gene. And the gene has a label. And when, you know, those labels are close to the nanoparticles, it become like a, we call a molecular sentinel. It go inside the cells and then give a very typical signal of that nanoparticles label. Mm-hmm. But when it see a certain gene defect, it's hybridized open, and suddenly the you know, it's opened the loop, and then you don't see the signal. And based on the plasmonic field of those nanoparticles. So this is one tiny example that you know our group and many other group, of course, are trying to use nanotechnology to help device, you know, sensors.
And how far along is that type of application?
Oh, we are very excited because we are working on several projects. One of the projects is currently funded by the National Institute of Health, how to use these nano-based detection modalities to look at high-throughput screening of drugs, for example. So, and there's many exciting work in the world by scientists all over the world now in that area.
So is there a lot of funding coming through for this type of work? I would imagine it would be a big part of the NIH's roadmap on nanomedicine, for example.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a roadmap on nanomedicine. In fact, it's a multi-agency kind of initiative, and this is one area I would say that could also change the face of how science is being conducted.
Absolutely, and I certainly hope that the translation will keep being accelerated with these things.
Yeah, definitely, that's what I hope too.
You know, I know that it's going to be important to roll these technologies out properly, and of course, sometimes that is much easier said than done. With that in mind, Tuan, fill us in a little bit on this organization called the Carolinas Photonics Consortium, which is a new partnership of researchers from five universities in the region.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk about the California Consortium, the CPC. Mm-hmm. Since I came to Duke, one of my goals at the Fitzpatrick Institute is how to team up with our sister organization in the area, in the Carolina, North and South Carolina, to create a technology base that could help, you know, the regional development. And from that, you know, working with my colleagues at University of North Carolina, UNC in Chapel, in Charlotte, mm-hmm. at the NC State in Raleigh, and then with the Western Carolina University, and also Clemson University, suddenly we find that we have a core of five universities that can, you know, work together to create that clusters of photonics research institution. And that provides really, I think, that very strong impetus to the region to develop this technology base. I think, you know, Carolinas, especially in the RTP, has been very strong on biotechnology.
Sure.
And in my vision, I see photonics could be the next platform to develop this kind of regional development. And I hope that, you know, together with our sister institution, we can really make that happen.
Do you see that trend starting to happen? I mean, I understand that one of the byproducts of the telecom bust several years ago was that, rightly or wrongly obviously, photonics kind of got a bit of a tarnished reputation at that point, at least in the business community. Is the consortium an effort to revitalize interest in the field?
Yeah, you touch a very, very interesting point. Of course, you know, let's say 5-10 years ago, when we think about photonics, you see about the telecom industry. But as we have discussed, and I would say mention that we think photonics in a much broader area. You know, even from the 8 program that we have, our institute, it has, you know, the nanophotonics, it has a biophotonics, it has all these photonics material. So I think if we define photonics in the broader sense, it will provide really a research, industrial, an education platform which is much broader. And with that, I really strongly believe that it will help this area to get into a next phase of development.
And do you see any interest coming from the powers that be in this area, I guess governmental agencies. Obviously, we have the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. We've had the North Carolina Microelectronics Center, devoting governmental resources to developing these areas of technology. Do you think that at some point we might see a North Carolina Photonics Center?
I think what I see is North Carolina multi-photonics center. That's what I like to see. Mm-hmm. I like to see a consortium of multiple institutions, and that we were achieving. And mentioning about the how we would like to get the federal government, the state government involved, this is a CPC goal, is how to create that cluster of resources. And recently we have a small start program, a seed program that we get funding from the UNC system, mm-hmm. to fund a startup, a very modest amount, but it's just a start. So we just send out a request for proposal, and each of the founding member will fund one start seed money, and we got really tremendous response. In fact, we got about 28 applications, and out of that we'll select out of five with a very independent review committee, and I think I'm very excited about to see that.
I see. And what will that entail? Will that be technology transfer into the commercial realm?
Yes, it's a translational program.
I see.
It's to have to help, research institution, research project be translated into the commercial factors.
Yeah, and of course, one of the ways that society ultimately benefits from the development of new technologies like this is when they are commercially viable.
Exactly. I think, again, I come to the point that I strongly believe in science for a purpose, mm-hmm. and how, we can get, scientific discoveries, innovations into the marketplace and to help society.
And has the military been interested in this type of technology?
Of course. A lot, yes. Yeah. There's a lot of technology. In fact, when I was involved with the national laboratories, there's a lot of technologies that some are in open literature, some are classified, that mm-hmm. Involve optical technology. It's a tremendous field in those kind of applications.
Photonics being used, for example, for field applications for detection of biological weapons and things?
Oh, definitely. There's a lot of going on that, because it's a very powerful technology. You're using light to look at signatures of compounds. So I think this has been going on for many years, and we'll continue to contribute to that field of national security, mm-hmm. and homeland defense. So I think I will see photonics a major contribution in that continuing.
I see. Well, Tuan, your inventions, which we didn't really get into specifically, but you have a very impressive track record of inventing some of these many devices we've been talking about, and you've been very modestly spreading the credit around, as you well should. But your inventions have already had quite a beneficial impact on society, and undoubtedly there will be much more of that. How does that make you feel as a scientist?
Well, I don't know how much I contribute, but I think what I know is that I have a lot of fun in what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, one of my dreams is that to do things and hopefully contribute something, even at a modest level, to society, to environment. And I think I really, again, very excited about my work.
And I'm sure that's part of your motivation also from leaving Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where you'd been for so long, and coming and joining us here in the Triangle and at Duke University.
Yeah, I think I'm very excited. In fact, I love Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where I have a very, I would say, exciting and a nice career. And it has always, the National Lab is always always a special place in my heart wherever I go. But I'm very excited to join Duke University and join the Fitzpatrick Institute, because, again, I see the potential by putting interdisciplinary team together to achieve things that we would otherwise be able to be by ourselves individually. And I think that is why Duke is one of the great place to work.
Well, Tuan, we certainly thank you for all of your many contributions to date, and we'll certainly be keeping an eye on what's going on over there at Fitzpatrick Institute at Duke and for the developments that are coming. And we thank you so much for joining us on Radio In Vivo today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
The
And we have got some wonderful guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check out the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy this program, we ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.